This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. This week's topic is hunger, and our guest is Claire Babineau-Fontenot, CEO of Feeding America. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Soy Checkoff. Feeding America's Claire Babineau-Fontenot is next. Wanted to take a moment and talk to soybean farmers. Nearly 500,000 of you are in the U.S. growing over 4 billion bushels of soybeans a year. And the Soy Checkoff is working hard to grow demand, innovating, testing, and showcasing new uses in new industries such as firefighting foam, tires, straws, shoes, or 1,000 other products. To learn more, visit unitedsoybean.org and keep on growing. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The number of people who are hungry and food insecure continue to climb, not only in the United States, but around the world. Claire Babineau-Fontenot, CEO of Feeding America, says even past the COVID pandemic, the numbers continue to climb with a nutrition policy system that is broken.
It's huge. In fact, it is at the highest rate that it has ever been since the USDA started recording food insecurity numbers in this country, other than during the economic downturn of 08-09. So to give you a number, it's nearly 50 million people. Nearly 50 million people, nearly 14 million kids. That's how big it is.
So when we talk about hunger today, many would suggest that during the COVID crisis, it was well documented how that hit so many families across the country. And many would have a mindset that things are better today in terms of numbers than they were during COVID. Is that the case?
It's not. So some things that are different. One, people understood it was happening because they could see it from their houses on televisions. They saw those long, long lines going to food banks. And what you can always count on in this country is that when we see a real need, we step up and we help. So during COVID, we stepped up and we helped. We did that in a bipartisan way. We provided far more resources than we ever had, and therefore fewer people wound up being food insecure during that time. Huh. But since then, those long lines have gone back to the inside of the buildings, and those lines have been growing. And I think part of our issue, Jeff, is that people don't realize it's happening. I believe when people do, and when people like you give me opportunities like this, I can help them to know that it's still going on. When people do, we'll step up again and we'll do what needs to be done.
What is the scope of Feeding America, and how many partnerships do you have to meet the goal of food insecurity?
Wow. Well, an important part of the partnership would be farmers, by the way. Feeding America provides a large, large amount of the government commodities that are out there. And it represents a lot of the food that we provide. So American farmers, growers, and producers are a big part of the Feeding America network. But we have over 200 food banks, really getting closer to 300 food banks when you count all of the different categories of food banks in our network. And this is the big, big number. Over 60,000 agency partners and meal programs. We have partner state associations, over 20 of them. We have co-ops, food co-ops, that are located in different regions as well. The way that I put it, Jeff, is Feeding America is where hunger is. And unfortunately, that's not one county in this whole remarkable nation where there are not people experiencing hunger. So we have to be in all of those places.
Is there one central thing that brings insecurity? Or do the elements that bring about food insecurity vary?
They do. So I'd say it's not one thing, but one of the things that Feeding America has been doing a better job of is actually talking to people experiencing hunger and asking them, so what's going on? Why are you in this line today? And they've been really good about sharing with us. And they say that there are a number of things that keep them in the line. Inflation is a big issue. Where inflation has been particularly challenging has been on the most nutritious foods, right? Something else they talk about is access is a problem for them. Access to nutritious food, and sometimes access to food at all, is a challenge, where they can't get to the grocery store. The grocery store is too far away and they don't have transportation. So transportation can be a barrier. They talk about their health and how they were doing fine. They were making ends meet. And then someone in their family that they loved ended up with a health problem. And then that just set everything off. And now they're struggling even to put food on the table. And they also talk about, in general, opportunity. Oh, and they definitely talk about housing. About not having access to affordable housing. But on the opportunity front, if you'll let me talk about that for just a little bit. I'm sure that there are people out there who don't do the right thing. I know I haven't always done the right thing in every way. My parents used to have to discipline me for not getting it exactly right. So I'm sure that that's true. But one of the things that your audience might not be aware of, or a couple of things. First, if you take out children, people with disabilities, and the elderly, the vast majority of people experiencing hunger in this country have at least one job. At least one. Sometimes more than one. And even with that job, they can't make ends meet. And we need, as a nation, to be joining forces to make that less true. Right? So we need to be doing common sense stuff, Jeff. We need to be, for instance, in our current system, it actually pushes you back into the line. We ought to be doing things to pull people out of the line or help people get lifted out of that line when the vast majority of them, that's what they want, right? And we haven't, as a nation, created the bridges that get people from that line to the opportunities that they want for themselves.
So there was a gentleman named Norman Borlaug, who, the father of biotechnology, who had an ideal and a concept to improve agriculture and plants to be able to solve nutritional needs. The Borlaug Institute recently having their meeting. And at that meeting, it was more than a dozen laureates said that the most under-discussed, the most ignored issue out of the discussion for Congress and for the White House was hunger.
Yes.
No one was talking about hunger. From a global perspective, close to 1 billion people today food insecure on this planet. But you don't have to look to Africa and India to find that. We have it here at home.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it looks differently in different places. One of the things I was excited to read is how the UN has now identified, under the caption of malnutrition, obesity. And it's one of the things that people really...
That's a paradox.
Yes. They struggle to wrap their heads around, right? So they're like, oh, well, this person must not need food because, you know, they're obese. Well, that's one of the signs of food insecurity. It's not just food insecurity is the reason we say food insecurity instead of hunger, for instance. And people wonder, well, why on earth are you using that term? Well, hunger is a state of being at a moment in time, right? It has to do with how do you feel? Is your belly full or empty? Food insecurity is about whether or not you get the access that you need in a consistent way, not only to food, but to the nutrition that you need in order to thrive.
What role has inflation and this inflationary cycle that we've been through had on your bottom line and your ability to provide food?
Wow. So as those lines that we talked about earlier went back on the insides of buildings, people assumed that the needs had gone away. When we assumed as a country that the needs had gone away, we stopped giving as much. all across our whole network, we have seen our fundraising dollars go down. We've also seen federal commodities go down. In fact, they've decreased by 45% since COVID. They've gone down by 45%. So we have less money, less food, more people, and we refuse to turn people away. So what do we have to do? We have to go buy the food. And we're buying the food where the most nutritious food actually has the highest rates of inflation on them. That's what's been happening. It has had a huge impact on our network and our ability to serve in communities in the way that we want to, and that people in those communities need us to. Sometimes they don't have grocery stores. They've just got us. And us includes these elderly people often working in a church basement pantry out of the goodness of their hearts, right? Because they feel called to feed the hungry. And sometimes they don't have the food they need in order to feed people who show up. And they count on Feeding America to be able to find those resources, make sure those resources get into their hands, so that then those resources can get into the hands and ultimately to the bodies of people who show up in need of help.
So a quick summary, less money coming in, and the money that you have, you're spending more to provide nutritious food for the people who need it.
Exactly.
Now let's talk about policy in the country.
Yes.
One of the biggest issues out of debating the farm bill that we need, and when we debated the farm bill that we have, was nutrition and nutrition programs. There is a mindset you can't take it away, and you really shouldn't change it at all. You should just give more. I have talked to individuals who suggested that they were working, they got a promotion, they were thrilled with the promotion, but then they realized the assistance that they were receiving was going down because they had advanced.
Yes, that is the paradox, right? That's the system that we have to unravel, and that Feeding America is going to work really, really hard to find partners, common sense partners who want to do something about that. And no one should want it to stay like it is, Jeff. So like you said, let's say it took me a long time to finally get a place to live for me and my kids, right? I qualified for Section 8 housing. Finally, after a long time, I was on the list. I finally get a safe place, a safe, clean place for me and my kids to live while I work. I get a $1 raise at work, and now I lose my housing. And now I have to go try to find an apartment that I can't afford. Or I get a $1 raise per hour at work, and now I don't get my child care subsidy. So I can't afford to send my kids to childcare. So we could do something about this, and I am so determined to be a part of building a coalition of people who decide we're going to do something about it. We can build bridges instead of, right now, we have benefits cliffs in this country. So what it keeps doing is telling people, don't save money, don't move up in the organizations that you're in, just keep relying in the way that you're relying on the system that you're relying on. I am not an advocate of having people have to be in those charitable food system lines. And there are things we can do to stop it.
So what role do USDA nutrition programs play? And is it as big a role as it has always been, greater or less?
Yeah. So I think the bridge will require that we continue to make it easier for people who already qualify for SNAP to get access to SNAP. And I believe then you build a bridge, and in that bridge, you help to create pathways for people to get off. So that line, the people who rely on SNAP, that should shrink, right? The people who are lining up at food banks and pantries all across the country, that should shrink too. But what will happen, what we've already seen happen, in fact, is if you make cuts in the nutrition program, right, federal nutrition program, and you haven't addressed the cliff, right, what you're going to do is push all those people into the charitable food system line. right? So they're going to go to food banks and food pantries. And right now, we don't have enough food to feed the people who are coming already. And the line is going to grow. So instead, we should pause. We should be thoughtful. We should expect people to work their way out of the federal nutrition program in each case that they can. I'm not talking about the elderly. I'm not talking about people who are differently abled. And I'm not talking about putting five-year-olds to work. But I am talking about finding pathways for people who could, if you had a bridge, actually work their way out of it. That SNAP was originally supposed to be, as was TFAP, the Emergency Food Assistance Program. These were supposed to be temporary. It wasn't designed for anyone to have to rely on it for the rest of their lives or for generations, right? So we need to go back to the original plan for it, and we need to pause and say, what do we need to build to stop making it more and more likely that more and more people will be relying on these systems that were not built for this kind of reliance? So I want to be about that. You know, Jeff, one other thing I didn't get a chance to say that, if you don't mind, I want to mention. You know, the largest growing group of people who are turning to the charitable food system right now? People who don't qualify for SNAP. So people who have jobs and who can barely make it, in part because of things like inflation, rising apartment costs, housing costs, etc. So that's the largest growing group that we have going to the charitable food system. People who do not qualify for any of those things. And the only place they can turn in order to make ends meet, to make sure their kids get fed, is here, is that within the Feeding America network and a network like this one.
So let's peel this onion back just a little bit if we can. And I'm going to offer what I feel like is an unbiased analysis. This new farm bill that we're talking about $1.5 trillion, with about 80% of that going toward nutrition programs. A debate, as most recently we were looking at this farm program, that the USDA during COVID added on. They spent more money into nutrition programs, and now there is a group saying, okay, COVID is over. It's time to pull that back and rein things in because this is an expensive bill. On the opposite side, there are those who say, you can't cut anything. You can't do this. Hunger is big. This is happening. You'll be taking food out of the mouths of children. You cannot cut back on SNAP.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you work this program? And I remember former House Ag Chairman Mike Conaway said that this should be a hand up, not a hand out.
Mm-hmm.
How would you, unbiased, work this program so that it's more affordable for the nation, meets the needs of people, but doesn't leave the hungry?
Yeah. Is number one, let's have a clear-eyed assessment of what's really going on with these programs to begin with, right? Where's the spending going? Is it making sense, right? So always, it's always a good idea to do a clinical, clear-eyed view of what's really going on with the system that we have today. Number two, let's look at the whole ecosystem. Right? Let's ask ourselves, so who's on SNAP? Why are they on SNAP? What would it take for them to get off of SNAP? We should not have an aspiration that people, the working class poor, have to be on SNAP for generation after generation after generation. What I think would be not a good thing is if we started with cuts without a bridge. That's what I think would be devastating. But to keep it like it is now, it is broken. It is broken. So people who say, let's just leave it like it is, I don't know if they must not be talking to people experiencing hunger, because people experiencing hunger don't like it like it is, right? So there are common sense things that we could do. As I said, we could phase in. What does it look like to have these bridges across some of these cliffs? How do we look at certification processes for some of these systems? And it's all within the federal government, a lot of these. So the rules and regulations exist inside of the federal government. The federal government could decide to do something that makes more sense. So how do you look at that ecosystem? How do you break it down? How do you understand what are you actually incentivizing? And how do you put in place a different kind of incentive, right? That says when you attain, you ought to feel good about getting a dollar more per hour, and you're not going to lose all of your benefits when you do. You're going to have a bridge that says you get to retain these, build up a little bit so that you can then leave and go get yourself an apartment. You get to retain these benefits as a bridge, and then you get to go do this, go and get housing for yourself. At the same time, the government ought to be thinking about things like, what is affordable housing? How do we get truly affordable housing out there? How do we work on those macroeconomic factors that are leading to some of these issues that people have? So I am not a person who believes we need to keep it just like it is, because like it is not working for the people that it's designed to work for to begin with. But I'm not also an advocate of just going in and taking a sledgehammer and saying, oh, we're getting rid of all of it. There are millions of people who actually don't get to eat. And I just want to emphasize this. There are millions of people who don't get to eat without some of these programs. And surely we're not a country that wants them to not get to eat. So that's what I'm an advocate for. And I'm ready to roll my sleeves up. And I know a lot of people, other people who are willing to do that too. And I think this is a great moment for us to do common sense solutions that are looking at the whole ecosystem and that expect people to actually get a hand up and to be able to reach for and grab the hand. Absolutely.
As we summarize and close, I want to share the side, I believe, of the farmer. What a frustrating day that there is a greater supply of base commodities and commodity prices are down and input costs are up. And we see the productivity gain, but yet we still have hunger.
Yes.
So that aside, what role do farmers play with Feeding America? Are they concerned and do they help?
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Do they help? And we don't. They're part of the engine of Feeding America. And every chance I get, I want to say thank you to farmers, growers, and producers in this country. I get to be on the ground. I've been to all 50 states and Puerto Rico just during the pandemic. I've gone to communities all across this great nation. And consistently, I witness when little kids get access to vegetables they've never seen before or fruit they've never seen before. I've seen a little girl cradling a watermelon. She was so excited. And she said, mine, right? And I'm like, yes, that gets to be hers. And it's because of American farmers, growers, and producers. I witness people getting access to dairy, which they always ask for more dairy, more protein, more produce, and they get access to through our system. Farmers are already helping. So farmers are a part of the Feeding America network right now. One of my big questions is, how can Feeding America be a better partner to farmers? So there are policy positions that we take. There are policy positions that farmers take. How can Feeding America be a better partner in understanding what the most important policy considerations are for farmers? And how can we show that we're great partners with them too? Actually, some farmers out there who are struggling themselves. There are farmers out there who are right on the brink, and sometimes, farmers themselves need to access the charitable food system. Oh my goodness, that should not be the case in this country. So I am not a person who believes that partnerships go one way. So one of the things I'm hoping to learn more and more of is what does a real I'll use a term, I think it was a science term, symbiotic, right? What does a real symbiotic partnership look like for an organization like Feeding America and for farmers, growers, and producers in the United States? And how do we know what matters the most to you? And how do we advocate for what matters the most to you as we together advocate for what's going to be good for people experiencing hunger?
Ms. Claire, we could talk longer and longer, and we still wouldn't cover all the topics. I just want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us and discuss this sensitive issue, and that is so very important. This is Open Mic. We are here, and that microphone is yours for the last word today.
I think the last two words from me, there's no question what they should be. It's going to go out to everybody who hears the sound of my voice, every farmer, every grower, every producer, every person who helps them to do what they do. Thank you.
Our thanks to Claire Babineau-Fontenot, CEO of Feeding America, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Soy Checkoff. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nellie.